In the wake of the George Floyd murder by a Minneapolis police officer in 2020, some law enforcement agencies have made efforts to improve their responsiveness to the local community.
When you look at it, there are certainly calls that only law enforcement can handle, and there are certain calls that a mental health professional is much better equipped to deal with, and no law enforcement is really necessary.
Eric Barden is deputy police chief in Seattle. They're trying a new model of public safety. Police and fire departments are now working alongside a new agency, the CARE Department. It employs what are called crisis responders, who get involved with people experiencing a mental health or addiction problem before it becomes a police matter. I'm David Freudberg. Stay with us for Protecting the Public from Humankind. Humankind is produced in association with GBH Boston. This special project, Protecting the Public, is supported by the Humankind Program Fund. Expanding public safety to include law enforcement along with other modes of community care. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. This is the intensive care unit at St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. This afternoon, physician Jonathan Enriquez, a boyish-looking cardiologist wearing scrubs, uses his gentle bedside manner in chatting with a patient.
Hello, good to see you again. All right. Remember the rest of the team, Dr. Godwin, Dr. Tripathi. How are you feeling?
Pretty good.
Okay, stomach still.
Still a little upset, but I feel better than I have been feeling.
All right. Sorry about that. We're doing everything we can to help you feel better.
Yes, you are.
And address the underlying issue. And it seems like since we started this medicine yesterday afternoon, hopefully getting a little better at least.
Oh, yes. Since you started the meds, yes.
Indicators on the blood test.
About three quarters of his time, Dr. Enriquez attends to his patients and leads a training program at the hospital for other heart doctors. But during the remainder of the work week, he can be seen performing a very different role. Are there days when you take off your scrubs and put on your police uniform?
There are days, yes, where I bring my gear to the hospital and I'll be seeing patients in the morning and have my, vest and belt and uniform in the corner and change and get a couple looks, walking out of the hospital. But
what are they wondering?
What's the cop doing here, in the hospital?
Wait a second. Aren't you the guy who just had a stethoscope on me?
Sometimes, yeah. But I think now the people in my area have gotten used to the fact that, okay, Enriquez is sometimes wearing different clothes. Sometimes they're more surprised when I dress up like we're wearing sport coats today as opposed to scrubs. That's usual, the normal garb.
About 2 years ago, John Enriquez became a part-time officer in the patrol division of the Roland Park Police Department in Metro Kansas City. Earlier in life, striving for what he describes as a higher purpose, John considered the priesthood or joining the military. Both his parents are physicians, and he ultimately settled on medicine. But Dr. Enriquez also felt called to policing. It was at a fraught time for law enforcement in the United States.
I couldn't take care of George that day. He was killed. But maybe by speaking with you today, I can make sure that his death would not be in vain.
Philonis Floyd testified to Congress in June 2020. The day after he buried his 46-year-old brother, George Floyd. 2 weeks earlier, as George lay handcuffed on the ground, a Minneapolis police officer pressed his knee on George's neck for a prolonged period, causing cardiac arrest. His heart stopped beating.
When I watched the video of his murder, he called all the officers, sir. The man who took his life, who suffocated him, for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, he still called them sir as he begged for his life. I can't tell you the kind of pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother who you looked up to your whole entire life die begging for his mom? I'm tired. I'm tired of pain.
The officer, Derek Chauvin, was later convicted of murder and sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison. The incident ignited an uproar of protest over police brutality, in some cases leading to civil unrest. Some community groups called for defunding the police. Carrie Pettis, near Boulder, Colorado, is a researcher who studies how psychology and social work intersect with our legal system. She has taught at Washington University in St. Louis and Florida State University.
Many individuals, people of color from various racial backgrounds, but especially Black and African American backgrounds, have significant fear of what is going to happen after an outcome with a law enforcement officer that historically and empirically in certain respects is quite legitimate.
In George Floyd's tense encounter with law enforcement, he experienced what some clinicians have called a behavioral crisis. Floyd told police he had claustrophobia and was having trouble breathing. A surprisingly high number of 911 emergency calls to police involve citizens who are undergoing mental health episodes.
They're going out on a mental health call.
Pam Bolarino is a licensed clinical social worker. She is vice president of acute care at Child and Family Services in New Bedford, Massachusetts, outside Boston.
In the past, probably more often than not, they would take that individual probably to the emergency room for safety, right? To be seen in the emergency room. They drop the patient off, they leave, right? Now that patient belongs to the emergency department.
But transporting someone and checking them into an ER is resource intensive. It's costly and can have the effect of clogging up hospitals when potentially cheaper and simpler interventions are possible. With state funding, Pam Bolarino's agency works in tandem with local law enforcement, providing social work professionals who sometimes accompany the police. She says use of social workers reduced by 30% the number of patients in that area going to the ER for behavioral health reasons.
I explained to the officers, like, you're going out on a call, whether it's mental health or substance abuse, you have a clinician with you. When you arrive, you make sure that that scene is safe. If the scene is safe and the patient doesn't have any, like, sharp objects on them or not threatened in any way, the officer steps aside and allows the clinician to take over.
Typically, how long does it take for the officer to assess whether there's any dangerous objects?
Every case is unique depending where they're responding to, right? Is it out on the street versus somebody's, like, apartment? So depending on the environment that the person is at determines how long it can actually take. It does not take long at all. And the officers then, they're still there while the clinician's meeting with the individual, but they're on the side allowing the clinician to do their job and assess.
Dozens of police departments in the United States now employ or contract with social workers. It's a small but growing trend aimed at de-escalating tensions that can spin out of control, like the George Floyd tragedy. Carrie Pettis says enhanced training for law enforcement is needed for a range of events that can result in a citizen feeling overwhelmed by police.
The broad set of skills to help them adequately assess the situation would be understanding what symptoms are associated with psychiatric crisis, understanding what symptoms are associated with a substance use disorder when somebody's significantly intoxicated, understanding trauma symptoms where a person may be behaving in a way that seems could be assessed as inappropriate, but it's actually related because they've had some kind of traumatic trigger, and understanding how to create a space between the law enforcement officer and the citizen that allows for a nonviolent interaction.
Carrie is founder of Wellbeing and Equity Innovations, which advises law enforcement.
There's more and more emphasis on trying to get these approaches in police academies or other law enforcement trainings. And nonviolent communication strategies would include an emphasis on empathy, compassion, respect, trying to make sure that each party is hearing each other with a goal towards de-escalation and problem solving. But there also needs to be a lot more of cross-system education on, you know, what do mental health professionals do? What resources are available in the community?
We're exploring efforts by public safety professionals, including police, to be more responsive to mental health and behavioral challenges for members of the community they interact with. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, Protecting the Public, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. Sometimes when certain communities, notably minority citizens, have contact with law enforcement, a pattern of past troubled interactions may lead to intense mistrust of officers. But behind the badge, police too may be experiencing their own kind of trauma over repeated exposure to a threat environment, including the potential of gun violence and traffic incidents. It can provoke anxiety for officers. Carrie Pettis.
Losing sleep, having very disturbing nightmares, intrusive thoughts during the day, ruminating on an experience, you know, thinking about it over and over and over again, drinking problems for sure, difficulty in their interpersonal relationships, anger and outburst, when they're not on the job, always perceiving danger. Depression, suicidality.
Those little traumas add up.
Physician John Enriquez.
There was a study from Dallas in 2020. 1 in 8 officers has some form of mental illness that they admitted. But when screened for mental illness, twice as many had some form of mental illness, whether it be depression and anxiety. So over 1 in 4 officers in that study screened positive for mental illness. But even though they did have mental illness of some sort, anxiety, depression, what a PTSD, only about 15% sought care.
And is that because the culture of policing makes it difficult to acknowledge vulnerability?
So I think that's part of it, David. And they found that reasons for officers not seeking care were that, number one, they may not have recognized that there was an issue. Even though they filled out the survey, they didn't realize that their sleep problems or inability to do, you know, find things pleasurable anymore, or the guilt or energy level was related to depression, but it was there.
One reason Dr. Enriquez was attracted to policing is that he became friends with cops he met at the gym and in his personal martial arts activities. They're human, he said. They have hard days and good days. I wondered if there are times when his training as a doctor has enhanced his police work.
Absolutely. You know, every day when I'm a cop or a physician, I meet people that I've never met before in my life, and they're having potentially one of the worst days of their life, right? If they call 911, it's not a good day, right? If they come in through the ER, get flown in on a helicopter, they're having a very traumatic experience and life-threatening many times. And so you as a physician or as a police officer have to be able to develop a rapport pretty quickly and make a connection with somebody, because otherwise you can't solve the problem. You know, if you're working against somebody instead of developing a partnership or collaboration or a relationship.
So even as a cop getting out of a cruiser at potentially a tense situation, you need to focus on developing a relationship with the person?
I'd say that's a lot of being a police officer and diffusing situations. Obviously, there's different tactical considerations. When I'm in a patient room, I don't worry about my distance from them from a self-defense standpoint, or, you know, if there's weapons involved or things like that. But from a police officer standpoint, I do. But yes, getting back to your question, you know, training in medicine is a lot of, you know, how do you connect with a patient? How do you develop a rapport? Where do you sit? How do you stand? How do you, you know, orient your body? The non-verbal communication that is emphasized more in med school and in postgraduate training. And I did carry a lot of that over into law enforcement, whether it's a motor vehicle accident or a domestic violence situation. If you can connect with them at their level, you can kind of bring them down, you know, once they realize that, hey, this person is with me, they're looking at me, they're treating me as a person, not just as a call or a number. It's not the cop versus the subject or suspect. It's, hey, what's going on here? You know, what can I do today to help? What happened? You know, tell me your story. Tell me your side. Tell me what happened.
The same questions you might ask a patient in the exam room.
Sure. I mean, the vernacular may be a little bit different, and you just have to meet the person at their level, wherever they are. And that's true in the, you know, in the exam room or out on the street. We think about responding to codes in the hospital. They say, before you check the patient's pulse, check your own pulse, right? To make sure that you are calm, you are sane, so that you can help that patient. And the same thing out in law enforcement.
So is that something, when you are wearing your police uniform and there's a particularly difficult event that you're summoned to, explain to me exactly what you're trying to pay attention to in yourself.
You can notice if your breathing is fast. You can notice if your heart is pumping. You can notice your facial muscles, if they're relaxed, or your jaw is clenched, or if your tongue is stuck to the roof of your mouth. You can notice if you're sweating or if your fists are clenched.
Do you ever notice that in yourself when you're on a difficult call?
Oh, sure.
And so how do you process the knowledge that, wait, I'm reacting in that way?
Yeah. You have to have a little bit of detachment, you know, as they say, that you have to be able to see or observe your thoughts, but not necessarily, or your emotions, but not necessarily fuse with them, right? I can have that reaction that when somebody is yelling at me or flicking me off or give me emotion that they're going to shoot me, right, with their fingers.
And have you encountered that?
Absolutely. That's part of policing. But then not necessarily responding to that, but saying, okay, that's normal for me to get anxious or fearful or upset, but I can see that like a leaf on a stream kind of just float by. That takes practice, though, so that when that day comes that you're able to, you know, fall on your level of training and experience. And so it is something I meditate, you know, once, twice a day, exercise regularly, try to eat healthy, because all of these things, physical, mental, emotional, are all tied together. But, you know, don't get me wrong, when that moment comes where there's a, you know, a warbler tone or one of the highest level priority calls, emergencies, you know, I do feel my heart rate, but I'm not thinking about the leave going down the stream. I'm thinking about, okay, you know, where do I need to be? You know, how do I get there safely and most efficiently? And as I'm heading there, gathering information from dispatch, looking at my, you know, MDT, my data terminal, and you take a big deep breath in, like 70% as much as you can, and then another deep breath, that maybe 95 to 100%, and then slowly let it out. And so the key is that you let that air out slower than you let the first two breaths in. And that can, even if doing just a few of those, lead to a decrease in your sympathetic nervous system, as I call it, the fight or flight system, you know, part of our brain and spinal cord that helps us, you know, jump higher and run faster when we're running from a tiger. And those things are enacted when we have a behavioral emergency, when somebody's yelling at you, or if there's a physical altercation, or in a code at the hospital when somebody's dying. Those are all stressful situations, and our nervous system turns up the volume on our, you know, blood pressure and our heart rate and our breathing, and it, you know, somewhat causes, you know, our amygdala, or our, you know, it's part of our brain that's the fight or flight, to be more active. But our, you know, prefrontal cortex, where our cognition and executive function is somewhat, you know, diminished. So we have to be able to manage that part of our nervous system so that we can access our prefrontal cortex and use our executive functioning to problem solve, to connect with others, and to be able to solve situations, you know, without these gross motor movements. But it's hard. And I'll be honest, it's a journey. It's not a destination. It's not, oh, I learned that and I'm good now. It's something that I have to practice every day.
Would you say it's something you've improved at?
Absolutely. But practice makes improvement, but doesn't make perfect, right? So,
is it the same set of interventions both when you're wearing your police uniform and when you're wearing your hospital scrubs?
Yes. For me, it is. Can't speak for others, but whether I'm in the hospital and ICU, people are crashing, like unstable or coding, you know, in cardiac arrest in multiple places in the ICU, or it's a busy day, you know, helicopters flying in. Yes, when I'm walking or going to other places, I'm doing my physiologic sighs or tactical breathing and mindfulness. Whether I'm out on the street, I'm doing it. And I'll tell you, and when I'm at home too, those are times I also have to employ the same things.
Physician Jonathan Enriquez in Kansas City, who's also a part-time police officer. This is the Seattle Care 911 Communication Center. In the most recent year, they fielded nearly 900,000 emergency calls. Call takers and dispatchers occupy a warren of several dozen cubicles. The callers are mostly citizens seeking help from police or fire personnel.
Do you see any weapons? Okay. How long ago did that happen? Okay, and what exactly did he threaten to do? Okay, is he following you right now? Okay, are you able to go a different direction from him? Okay. Did you want to have an officer?
Because normal telephone ringtones coming nonstop would be maddening, the system signals that a call is waiting through a series of gentle tones heard throughout the room. I wondered about the people who take the calls here. The total staff numbers about 150. In many cases, they're the actual first responders to an emergency. They may be listening by phone to unsettling events as they unfold. Spencer Coles has been working here for 8 years. What is your title, please?
I'm the communications supervisor here.
So you're in charge of this whole room?
Yeah, we have a supervisor team, and we all kind of share that workload of kind of overseeing the day-to-day operations, ensuring policies and procedures are being followed, and supporting the employees in whatever way we can.
So if there's a particularly disturbing event that somebody might get called about, it's a task of you as a supervisor to check in on that person. Are you doing okay?
At times I will do that, but typically I would leave that to our dedicated peer support team to do that. However, I mean, we all have the ability here to check on our peers, and we will do that if we identify that, you know, somebody might need that.
And there's an employee assistance program at this call center?
Yes, that's correct.
And do people avail themselves of those services?
I can only speak for myself, and I will say I've used those services before. I have certainly faced challenges in my job here in the past after handling especially difficult calls, and having a confidential person to talk to that about.
Kind of a trained counselor.
Yeah, exactly. Has helped a lot. I found that what I used to do was I would take on all of this trauma and bottle it up inside. And to have somebody that I can kind of release that to is tremendously helpful.
What kinds of events or incidents might have triggered some of that?
Our employees here come from all different walks of life, and everybody has different and unique triggers, I would say. For me, personally, I mean, I have had to hear people die on the phone, and dispatching for the crane collapse, which was a very large-scale incident happening. Those are the types of things that, if left unchecked, will keep you up at night.
And so to check them is to consult with a counselor, help me process this difficult experience?
Sure. You know, it works differently for everybody, what works best for them in terms of processing maybe what they heard. For me, that looks like maybe talking to a therapist about it, talking to one of our peer support members, just to make sure that I'm not just solely internalizing what I've heard or dealt with.
Coming up, we ride along in an official van of crisis responders working for the city of Seattle, and we meet an unusual married couple at the center of how the city intervenes to help residents who are in trouble. When Protecting the Public continues on Humankind in a moment.